From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Election Day is next Tuesday, 8 days from now, November 5th. Voters head to the polls to make selections for candidates in a wide range of races, and one of those races is Monroe County Court Judge. Now, we routinely hear from voters who say they really have no idea what to think of judicial candidates, what to look for when assessing them, how to learn about records or priorities, and that's why here on the talk show, we make an effort to talk to judicial candidates at length and give our listeners an opportunity to ask the candidates questions and hear their perspectives. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from candidates for State Supreme Court. And this hour, we're sitting down with candidates for Monroe County Court Judge. We will discuss a wide range of issues, including balancing justice for victims with goals of rehabilitating offenders and the roles of the courts in the opioid crisis and more. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour, and we'll go around the room. Hello to Kyle Steinbach, who is an assistant district attorney for the Monroe County DA's office, the deputy bureau chief for local courts. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You got it. Also with us is Judge John DeMarco, who is a Monroe County court judge and an acting Supreme Court justice. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Judge.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Karen Bailey Turner, who is currently serving as an associate attorney at the Mental Hygiene Legal Service and the Appellate Division, 4th Department.
Thank you very much.
As one of the titles. Did I get it?
That's correct.
Did I get it? When we've got doctors and attorneys, the backgrounds are long and often very distinguished. It's nice to have Karen here. Thank you, Karen. And also with us is Michael Dallinger, who served for 9 years as prosecutor in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office, and most of the last three has served as principal law clerk to Monroe County Court Judge Christopher Chacho. Welcome, Michael. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Evan. Thanks for having us.
I'll start there with you, Mike, and we'll kind of go back around the table, and I'll ask all of you, frankly, just to start, I think it's helpful for listeners to hear why you're running, and maybe if you agree with some of the voters' frustration who say, well, I don't know anything about judges, so tell me about you. Do you hear that?
Yes. Well, I'll start with the second question first. I get it all the time out on the campaign trail since I first got into this race back in January. Voters just they don't know as much about what the judges do and what qualifies someone to be a good judge. And so that's why I appreciate you having this program. Hopefully we can educate the public a little bit. Yes, my name is Mike Dallinger. I'm running for Monroe County Court Judge. My career in law began in 2008. I actually graduated from Albany Law School in 2007. And I wanted to find a way to make my law degree work and do some good in the community that I grew up in. I was born and raised here in the town of Brighton, and I decided to move back here to raise my family. So I got a job at the Monroe County District Attorney's Office. I was hired by then DA Mike Green, and I started out in the DA's office, and I think that the District Attorney's Office is an ideal place to start for somebody who wants to practice criminal law, really the Public Defender's Office also. And the reason is you get thrown right in. I did my first jury trial when I was working in the DA's office for 3 weeks. That experience is just tremendous. You're on your own, and you really have to pick it up as you go right from the start. So I worked in the DA's office for a total of 9 years. I worked my way up through prosecuting misdemeanors in town and village courts, through prosecuting misdemeanors in Rochester City Court, and then started working in Monroe County Court, where I work until today. I prosecuted nonviolent felonies in county court, violent felonies, gun cases, drug cases, homicide cases. So I've tried every kind of case that could come before a county court judge, just about. And after my time, I left the district attorney's office. I got the opportunity to work as a law clerk for one of the county court judges, which I've done for basically the last, it'll be 3 years in January. And I think that's really been an invaluable experience for me in terms of being a candidate for county court judge, because it's very rare to get the opportunity to sort of step behind the bench and see the cases from a judicial perspective and get to research the difficult issues that come before judges on a daily basis. So I've been doing that, working with a tremendous judge, Judge Christopher Chacho, for the last just about 3 years. And the reason I wanted to run for county court judge is I sort of realized very early on in my career prosecuting felonies that these judges make very important decisions that have real life consequences and real impacts in people's everyday lives. And I think that given my experience and the perspective that I bring, I'm an ideal person to be making those decisions. So, you know, I grew up in this community and I care deeply about it, and I'd like to be making those decisions.
Karen Bailey Turner.
Thanks, Evan. So I currently am a mental hygiene legal service associate attorney
And a lot of people don't know the mental hygiene legal service is actually within the judiciary. So that's why I'm a court attorney as well at the Appellate Division, Fourth Department. That's my current hat. And what I do, Evan, is I represent mentally ill patients in psych centers, at hospitals, daily in court hearings. And the court where I practice, in county court and Supreme Court, I've been practicing for probably over 20 years. The courtroom is my home. I'm at home in the Hall of Justice. And I've decided, after representing thousands of clients, both as an assistant public defender, as a private criminal defense attorney, and now as an attorney specifically representing the mentally ill, that I am ready to make the decisions that judges must make instead of asking for them. I'm highly experienced, committed to justice, and, you know, after working over 20 years in courtrooms and representing all types of people, you get a good sense of the decisions that need to be made. You get a good sense of the impact that you can have on their lives. And more recently, in fact, as a criminal defense attorney, I didn't have the experience I have now in terms of understanding mental illness. I cross-examine psychiatrists and psychologists every day. In my current position, I've had to learn the science as well. Psychology, psychiatry, specific treatments, disorders, et cetera. And I think that, in terms of my experience, is just icing on the cake. Prior to that, I represented thousands of clients as a public defender and in private practice. And in doing that, I've had to be aware of clients' needs. I've had to be an advocate. And I believe, after all that experience, that I'm ready to lead the courtroom proceedings and I'm ready to make decisions. So that's why I want to take it to the next level and serve the community. I don't think it's just about putting on a robe. It's about serving the community, and that's important. So that's my next way to serve. Additionally, I'm unique. In addition to having practiced privately, having practiced publicly, having handled large caseloads, I would be actually the only current woman on the bench, and there's never been a person of color elected to Monroe County Court. And I have to say that over my broad experience, I've come to realize that a broad range of people come into our court system. And I think it is important that our courts, particularly judges, reflect the community that they're in. So those are my multiple goals that I have.
Okay. John DeMarco.
All right. Good afternoon. First off, I want to thank WXXI and you, Evan, for covering our race. As you indicated at the outset, there's not a tremendous amount of coverage of the judicial races, particularly county court race. So I want to thank you for doing that. I'd also like to say that, you know, the race for county court, in my opinion, is just as important as the race for county executive and district attorney. Our interactions with the community impact tens of thousands of lives in this county year in and year out. So I think from the voter standpoint, this should be very informative. I'd also say parenthetically that although we're only going to be here for a little short of an hour, each of us has a website. My website is judgejohndemarco2019.com, and there's a lot of information. As a matter of fact, I joke with people on the campaign trail, if you're having a hard time getting to sleep tonight, check out my website, 10, 15 minutes, that should do the trick. I've been working in the Rochester legal community the last 34 years. The last 18 as a judge. I was twice elected in the town of Irondequoit as town justice, elected 10 years ago to the Monroe County Court, was appointed by the chief judge to become an acting Supreme Court justice, which I currently am, and the supervising judge over all the treatment courts in the 8-county area. Before that, I spent 23 years practicing law in this community, which certainly adds needed and additional perspective. I know that we have a lot to cover, so I'm going to make this part of it short, but there are two seats open this year for Monroe County Court. I am attempting to retain my seat, and of course, there is one other seat. And with respect to my three colleagues that are here, all of them are prepared to fill that other seat, but I'd like to be reelected to the bench and continue bringing my 34 years of experience to this job to benefit the people of Monroe County.
All right, thank you. And Kyle Steinbach.
Hi, thanks for having me again. County Court, the most important thing is that I don't believe a lot of people understand what goes on in county court on a day-to-day basis. And when I break it down to people, the easiest way to put it is county court is felony criminal cases. After grand jury, it goes to county court where everyone's arraigned again under the new indictment, and they're handled in county court. So as far as my experience, I started out here locally, born and raised in Greece, went to school, law school in Maryland. And after I went to law school, I was asked to be a judge, judge's clerk down there, the Honorable Stuart Berger, where I was his clerk for a period of about 8 months. And then after that, I went to private practice law firm, and I practiced mostly civil law, but I did do some criminal defense work. It was by chance that I came back for a wedding, my father-in-law's second marriage, and at the table was Sandra Dorley. Sandra Dorley was a friend of my father-in-law's. We got to talking. I wasn't really happy about what I was doing down in Maryland, and my wife and I were ready to come home and start a family. After that discussion, I applied to the district attorney's office, and I'm working on my 14th year in the DA's office. Of those 14 years, almost 9 of them were spent in the Violent Felony Offense Bureau. I've handled I've handled 21 homicide cases, 75 violent felony offense trials, and I've supervised roughly 33,000 criminal cases. So I have some experience in the arena of criminal law. Why do I want to be a judge? Be honest with you, I'm in this position I'm in now because I got a phone call from the judge that vacated the seat, and she said, we need you in this position. And after we talked and going to some events and seeing the need, I felt it was time to throw my hat in the ring, because everyone can complain about what's going on, but very rarely do people try to do something to change it. I have seen the crime in this city, seen how it affects families. I've given hugs to mothers whose children were murdered. I have a young family at home, and I would like to do something to make this community a better, safer place to live. The crime rate in Monroe County is through the roof. It's one of the highest in the state, and I believe by doing this, I can attempt to make a difference and make this place a safer place to live for my family.
Those are the four candidates for two seats, and I guess I want to ask the three men in the room to address something Karen brought up, which is that Karen brought up the fact that she's not only running for the priorities that she sees for the bench in her career, but also for what it might mean to a community that has never elected a person of color and doesn't elect a whole lot of women. So there's three white men you're running against. Kyle, does it matter? Does that representation matter in this community?
Well, I the fact that the community has never elected a person of color, I don't necessarily know if I agree with that statement. There's plenty of people of color that are elected in this community. As far as the countywide election, does it matter? Yes. Do we need diversity? Yes. And that's something that the voters are going to have to choose from this year. Not only is it diversity that matters, but it should matter for the qualifications also. So hopefully your listeners and everybody else looks into everyone's qualifications and makes the informed decision.
Okay, John?
Well, I think clearly from a gender perspective, we have a number of women in the community that are on the bench, both at the city court level, previously in the county court level, and at the Supreme Court level as well. We certainly have people of color on the bench as well. But without question, Karen Bailey Turner would be a welcome addition to the bench. I just think that the bench should, when possible, reflect the makeup of the community.
Okay. And I'll ask Mike the same thing. Mike Dallinger, go ahead, Mike.
Yes, I personally applaud Karen for her comments on the need for gender and racial diversity on the bench. And I'm proud to be part of a slate of candidates that is quite diverse. If you look at the Democratic slate of candidates at the very top of the ticket, we have Meredith Vaca for State Supreme Court. She's an Asian American woman. We have Shawnee Curry Mitchell for district attorney. She's an African-American woman. We have Karen Bailey Turner, obviously, sitting here, an African-American woman for county court. And then, obviously, Adam Bello for county executive. So I'm proud to be part of the diverse slate of candidates.
Now, you all have talked about your qualifications and background. I want to start with a listener question. Diane in Rochester wrote us this morning to ask, why do judicial candidates run on party lines at all? Let me start around the table and ask Kyle. Should voters who don't know much about judicial candidates when they're in the booth, does it mean something different when it's a Republican or a Democrat on the bench, or do you think it's more individual?
Does it mean something different?
Generally speaking, judges and Republicans and Democrats.
I don't believe so. It's more individual. The individual that you elect. Should judges be political choice? I don't think so, but there's no other system that's in
place. It's the game we got?
Yeah. Well, if it's appointed, then the people that do the appointment have the power, and they're the ones that you have to bow down to get the appointment. So how else do we do it? If it's not a political race, how else do you do it? So if you stand out there and say, I'm a Republican, but we can't give you our opinions on any of the laws. So what does that matter? I'm a Democrat, but we can't give you our opinions on any of the laws. So it really matters on the individual and what their beliefs are, because whether they're Republican, conservative, independent, working family, it doesn't matter. Where do they stand on the law as an individual, and how are they going to apply that law when they're on the bench? That's what matters.
Okay, John?
I don't think I disagree with that. First of all, I'm very pleased to be endorsed by six political parties. But at the root of the question is, I can tell you when I was elected 10 years ago to county court, and I walked into my first breakfast judges meeting on a Thursday morning, it is very clear to me that once you are elected, you check that party at the door. When people come before you in court, you don't know what party they're in, and you treat all people exactly the same. So it's part of the logistics in arriving here, but I think clearly after the election is over, a party means very little.
Okay.
Yeah, I get that question often, and more recently, you know, along the trail, people have this idea that the law is this clear, solid thing, and it certainly can be applied regardless of party. Two words, judicial discretion, right? And I think that's very important in terms of who is on the bench. And I think that's why our voters have to look at our experience and look at what we're coming to the bench with. For example, if a case comes in and someone is convicted and, you know, there's a range of 5 years to 25 years, judicial discretion, right, informs how a judge might decide that issue or what a sentence is appropriate. So we do have, the law is not so simply clear that every decision is already made.
But can I probe that a little bit? Because are you saying that Democrats and Republicans on the bench might handle sentencing differently?
I'm saying that if you look at the philosophies of those on the bench, right, or those, the parts of the slate that they're at, and you look on and you look at criminal justice issues, maybe, yes. But as judges, judicial candidates, we are allowed to reach broadly. For example, I'm a Democratic candidate, and I'm also on the Work and Families party line, right? You know, my colleagues have different parties. And I think it matters, and it's important to our law that judicial candidates be allowed to reach broadly. For example, you know, Mike and I had to do primaries to get our additional parties. We didn't have to do write-ins, right? We just had to go and have voters approve us or vote for us for the primary. So I think, you know, in an ideal world, it wouldn't matter. But I think the voters have to educate themselves, you know, about the background of those before them. And I can tell you that as a defense attorney, having represented people, thousands of clients over the years as an assistant public defender. So I've represented poor people on violent felonies and nonviolent felonies. Some have been guilty, some have been not. Trials, hearings, hundreds of pretrial conferences. That's a lot of experience. In private practice, I've also done civil rights for prisoners and represented people with means and people without means. And now I represent the mentally ill. So I think in looking at that combination of experience, it gives you a sense as a judge of some of the things that I would be able to handle after representing clients for thousands of years. And that's very different from prosecutors. Prosecutors do not represent clients. Prosecutors do not have the duty of effective representation for clients. And I think in representing clients, you get a good sense of people, and you get a good sense of making sure that defense attorneys effectively represent their clients, mm-hmm. and also that prosecutors follow their ethical obligations. So I think that's a different perspective to come from, to lead from the bench. And I think that's what judges do. They lead from the bench.
Michael Dollinger, is there a partisan aspect to what people ought to expect out of judges?
Well, that was the original question. Sorry, yeah. I was answering, listening to the answers, and I sort of got off track here. Is there a partisan?
Well, I mean, essentially, what Diane's asking is, why are we even seeing party lines, and should we expect judges to essentially do their work differently if they are Republicans versus Democrats?
Well, I'll take the second half of that question first, and I think the answer to that is no. I don't think that you should expect judges to do the job differently, whether you're Republicans or Democrats.
Maybe you don't expect that, but do you think that in practice that's what happens?
I don't think so, no.
Okay.
No, and I can tell you that's based on my experience appearing in county court for almost a decade and also working now in county court. I've had the chance to observe judges from different political parties who get elected. And I'll tell you this, too. If you do make those assumptions, you might often find them wrong. You might find that judges who are Republicans or conservatives that you would expect to act in a certain way do not act in that way. And quite frankly, if you have some preconceived notions about the way that Democrats might act when they get elected, you may be surprised by the way that some of the Democrats act. I can tell you that I agree with what some of the other people have said. I don't think that electing judges is really a perfect system by political party, but it's a system that we have. And I can tell you that I'm proud to have a very diverse set of endorsements. I'm endorsed by the Democratic Party, the Independence Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Serve America movement. And I think that what I hope is that those parties don't really do their nominating and their designating on ideological grounds. It's that they look at the candidates and they think who's best qualified for the job, and that's who they put forth.
All right, I want to ask our guests, and again, we're talking to four candidates for two seats for Monroe County Court Judge. You just heard Michael Dollinger, Karen Bailey-Turner, John DeMarco, Kyle Steinbach, all going to be on the ballot next Tuesday. That's 8 days from now. I'm going to start with John DeMarco on this question, and I moved to Rochester in 2003, right around the time when one of my first stories working commercial television news was going down to Yates County, and the judge at the time, county court judge at the time, Patrick Falvey, was instituting a drug treatment court. And I was seeing the landscape of expectation change a little bit, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but away from just something purely punitive to something that seeks to understand addiction and do it in a constructive way in the justice system, while also looking at responsibility, accountability, et cetera. And I know all of our guests have a lot to say about this. John DeMarco, how do you view drug treatment, the role of the courts, your work, and especially in light of the opioid crisis now? Because in 2003, we were looking at different kind of crises. Now we're in the throes of an opioid crisis. How does this all fit together when it comes to the work of a judge?
So I'm going to try to keep an answer here with respect to my colleagues who I know want to chime in on this. So first of all, just some context real quick. We are celebrating the 30th birthday of treatment courts in the United States. They were started right here in Rochester in about 1989. Judge Schwartz brought the concept from Miami, Florida here. Over the last 30 years, we have been the gold standard in treatment courts. At any given time, we've got about 700 defendants in our court. They have evolved over time. They were an against-the-wind, radically liberal concept that was the belief by the public. But after we became the fifth court in the nation and the first court in New York State, they've now evolved to 3,300 treatment courts worldwide. I have devoted more than half of my Superior Court career to the treatment courts. I was selected by Judge Schwartz to take those courts over and Judge Doran about 5 or 6 years ago from a supervisory capacity. It's been a tremendous honor and privilege to serve in these courts because I can see what they do. Some further context, 2016 in the United States, we had almost 70,000 deaths in this country to overdose death, more than the Vietnam War. I serve on the heroin task force here in Monroe County for the last 2 years. We've had approximately 400 to 500 overdose deaths. Year to date, we have 642 overdose deaths and 91 fatals. The presence of fentanyl has been a game changer. And in order to address the crisis that's going on in this community, last December, I spearheaded the commencement of the first opiate stabilization court in this county to stop people from dying, setting aside the benefit in terms of dispositional benefit to defendants, but simply trying to save lives. I'm happy to report that we've had about 120 defendants through the program since last December. Sadly, we've only lost one life. That's one life too many. But we've saved many, many lives. We have introduced medication-assisted treatment in the jails, spearheaded a veterans pod in the jail. So there's a lot of components. We have five treatment courts in Monroe County. We have the felony drug court, otherwise known as judicial diversion. We've got the drug court, the mental health court, the DWI court, the veterans court, which I've been heavily involved in, addresses veteran-specific issues for those that are caught up in the criminal justice system. Listen, it's a staple now in every major courthouse in the country. We have learned over time that from a clinical standpoint, you've got to address the root of the problem. I think all of us in this room that have been in the criminal justice system for the last, I think everybody here probably give or take near 20 years, myself over 30, the majority of offenses in our building are nonviolent felony offenses. A supermajority of those offenses are because of alcohol or drug addiction. If you're not addressing drug or alcohol addiction, you are not reducing recidivism. So it's a very important part of the courthouse. I've devoted my professional career as a judge to it, and I couldn't be prouder of that.
And real briefly, before I turn to your other colleagues on this, I think you're right to point out that early on, it was viewed as sort of a right-left political paradigm. I remember some of those conversations 15, 16, 17 years ago. Why do you think that right-left paradigm sort of melted away here, and this is generally viewed as much more of the proper approach to approaching addiction and prosecution, et cetera?
So, along with Woodstock, it's the 50th anniversary of the war on drugs. Governor Rockefeller thought that the way to do this was to make us the toughest state in the union and max everybody out. I remember the first drug court that I tried as a defense attorney after I left the DA's office. And they gave my client 17 years, and that was overkill. So it was Republican conservative movement against a Democratic liberal movement. But I think time has proven the more progressives right on this issue. If you want to reduce crime, you want to save taxpayers' money, treatment court is the way to go. It's proven. It is the most studied and reviewed court in the history of the criminal justice system.
And is the war on drugs largely a failure?
I think clearly it was. I think we need to handle drugs properly in the community, but from a criminal justice perspective, this is the better route to go.
All right, Karen Bailey Turner, Michael Dollinger, Kyle Steinbach, I want all your takes on this. And given the fact that John DeMarco has the advantage of incumbency here and that he is an acting court judge, I want your views on not only this issue, but if you think it's being handled properly or if you do things differently. And I'll start with Karen. Go ahead.
Over the years, I think having the option of drug treatment court, mental health court, DWI court, et cetera, has been wonderful. It's a wonderful way, first of all, to get client to realize that he and she has a problem. Because we've got to start there. If that's not there, then it's very difficult. So for clients who've wanted those dispositions and done the work, it's been great. But it doesn't always work out. Sometimes people have to, go through things several times before it does. And I saw, it's interesting, because I've been around long enough for when we had drug treatment court, but we didn't have mental health court. And what I realized very early as an attorney is that we talk about these issues separate, but a lot of times they're really comorbid. A lot of times, people who have mental health issues and mental disorders are actually self-treating with drugs. So a lot of times, there's a combination and a combined need for treatment. And what I've come to realize even more in the work I do now, because I think as a criminal defense attorney or defense attorneys just sending things to those courts, a lot of times you really don't understand the symptoms and the need for treatment, even to be able to advocate for that client or to know why you're sending it. You send it to those courts, you hope it works out, and that's it. Whereas I've had a chance to see it work, I've had a chance to not see it work, and currently I understand the symptoms and the need for treatment more. And I think that's a major advantage to being on the bench with that knowledge. So I commend our courts for the drug treatment and also the paradigm shift that we've had to realize that we don't need to just incarcerate. Sometimes if somebody has a disease, then we need to offer them an alternative. However, I think we need more work in realizing that there are mental issues as well that are comorbid with drug use, and sometimes people self-treat.
Do you think the courts are fair to people with mental illness?
That's a broad, you know, sometimes I've seen that, sometimes I have not. But I think, to be honest, that the courts have to truly have an understanding. The courts and the lawyers who practice before them have to have a better understanding of mental illness before I can even say whether they're fair or not. Mental illness is broad and it crosses race, class, age, etc. And I think sometimes people may, you know, appear to be agitated or have impaired judgment and not be diagnosed or identified that it's a mental disease that they have. And I think until we have a better understanding, then I think we'll be fairer. But I think it's a great opportunity that at least we are looking at these individuals, because these are mental disabilities and substance abuse disorders. They're disabilities. And we need to enhance the ability of the court to be able to handle these cases.
Michael Dollinger, how would you approach drug treatment court, and related issues?
I'd like to, if I could, just circle back to something you asked Judge DeMarco right
sure.
at the end. You asked him, why do you think the political opposition to the treatment courts has fallen away? And I would say that that is clearly because of the proven effectiveness of the courts. And I think that they've proven to be so effective that it's just you can't sustain an argument on either side of them. I'd also like to say I believe that I'm the only person who has extensive experience practicing in one of these courts. I spent the bulk of my career in the district attorney's office in what's called the Special Investigations Bureau. In that bureau, we prosecuted felony-level drug cases and gun cases. Felony-level drug cases are all nonviolent cases. So those cases go to judicial diversion court to be arraigned. And the judicial diversion court was created by statute in, I believe, 2011, maybe 2010. And that was right around the time that I started practicing those kind of cases. And one of the things that I prided myself on, being an assistant district attorney, was that I would go into the court, and we were often sort of instructed to oppose entry into the judicial diversion court. Because the reason that they told us to propose it from the district attorney's office perspective was that you plead guilty up front to get into the court, and you have to cooperate with the terms that the court gives you. You have to be clean for a year, you have to be working, you have to be in school. There are other things that you have to comply with. At the end of that term, if you're successful, the judge has the discretion to do anything up to and including vacating your prior guilty plea, dismissing the case, and sealing the record. So from the district attorney's office, they looked at it like they would oppose that because it gave too much power to the judge over the case in the end. One of the things that I prided myself on is if I got a case that went there and I really believed that the person was offending because they had a drug issue, I would consent to their entry into that program, because I thought that that was the way to really address the underlying criminal behavior. And if your goal is criminal justice and crime prevention, addressing that underlying problem that's causing the criminal behavior is really the way to go.
Did that get you any hot water with your bosses?
Occasionally, yeah.
But it was the right thing to do, you thought?
Yes. I believed that then, and I believe it now.
And so would it now be sort of a continuation of the work that's being done if you're elected?
What I was going to say is the position did soften over time. So it over time, I think even the people in the district attorney's office came to realize the effectiveness of the judicial diversion court. And sorry, I missed what you just asked.
Well,
me.
I mean, do you view your potential election as just continuing the work that's being done or changing the work that's being done in drug court?
Well, part of it depends on, so I work in county court now, and there are two judges who are assigned to the judicial diversion part, and that's where all the nonviolent felony cases go to be arraigned. And then those two judges take care of whether to, they screen the people for clinical and legal eligibility. So I would be thrilled to be one of the two judges who was assigned to that part, and I think that my experience makes me an excellent candidate for that. However, if I'm just one of the other four judges on
sure.
county court, you don't really get a chance to see those cases until they've already been to judicial diversion court, and the ones that would be assigned to me would already have been rejected or not accepted for some reason.
Sure.
So you don't really have the ability to send them back there once they get to you at that point.
Okay. Kyle Steinbach, how do you view this issue?
Well, first of all, about treatment courts. Treatment courts are absolutely a necessary thing in the world today. My belief is that the people who are in the throes of addiction need an opportunity to help themselves. And sometimes just sending somebody to jail with no help, they're not going to get help. You say they're in jail for a year or 365 days. When they get out on 366th day, they're going to go right back to doing drugs. So how have we helped society? We haven't. we've taken it, we've removed that problem for a year, but they're going to get right back into it when they get out. So treatment courts, the idea is that they help themselves. I've talked to plenty of people in the community whose loved ones were in the throes of addiction, and they say, but for the fact that my brother, my sister, my son was arrested and helped through treatment courts, they'd be dead right now. So this is a very good thing for this community. How is it being handled currently? The issues now are, that I see them currently, is how to determine who's in the throes of addiction and who's selling drugs and are saying, hey, I need to go to this treatment court because I need help. I sell drugs to help my habit. But now we're just we're opening the hen house door to the fox and letting them in and be like, hey, Mr. Drug Seller, come meet your new clients. Because part of the treatment program is group treatment, sending them into group homes. Hey, we need help. We need all of this. So the role of the judiciary for these treatment programs has to be to determine who we can help and who's there to actually hurt in the long run. And that's where it's tough. Sometimes people get into these treatment courts because they have a possession charge and they do possess, let's call it heroin, fentanyl, whatever it is. Okay, so they say, I'm an addict. That was personal use. But they have $3,500 cash on them. In my experience, an addict with fentanyl doesn't have $3,500 cash in them. That, to me, indicates more of a seller than an addict. So we have to try to, and as a judge, you'd have to try to delineate between the two so that we can help the people that need the help and don't let the people in that are there to hurt.
Is the system being abused right now?
I think in many instances, yes, sir.
And is that, who's responsible? Who's to blame for that?
Well, as Mike said, when I started in the DA's office, if you sold any kind of controlled substance, it was a mandatory 1 year in state prison. Now it's not. Judicial diversion programs available. I know of a lot of instances where people that, myself personally, I don't believe are addicts, were allowed into the judicial diversion program and got out with no criminal record and nothing on their record, no blemish on their record for what occurred. And the most infamous is the, I won't bring specific instances up, but yes, sometimes it's abused, absolutely.
But again, it sounds like you think the judges are to blame for that?
Well, the judges are in the sole discretion of who's allowed into the program or not.
Okay, so Judge DeMarco, you agree with that?
I don't, respectfully. A couple things that I just want to say again, because the listeners haven't spent 20 or 30 years in this, so I want to be sensitive to that. Again, the majority of cases in the criminal justice system are nonviolent cases. What does that mean? These programs are not available to someone that robs a bank, someone that is engaged in a rape, someone that's involved in a violent assault or a homicide. These are not drug treatment court cases. We're talking about everything else. The registered drug court, which is a misdemeanor / felony drug court, those cases only arrive upon consent of the district attorney's office. So the prosecutor has a huge role to play in what comes in that court. When we talk about judicial division, that's a fancy way of saying felony drug court. As Mike Dollinger indicated, that was promulgated. That's a law now in New York State. Every single county out of the 62 counties in New York State has to have a judicial diversion court. What makes that court different? First of all, the legislature decided, you know what? These drug courts that are all over the state, they work. They're discretionary in every county. But after 25 years, they said, you know what? They work. Now we're going to make them mandatory. So the legislature said, okay, you've got to have this this court in your county. But the change was, rather than having it up to the discretion of the district attorney, on felony cases, nonviolent cases, the judge gets the final word as to whether or not the case comes in after a hearing between both defense counsel and the DA as to whether it's an appropriate case. I'll conclude with this. One thing that Kyle alluded to, and this is a struggle for courts. I wrote a decision, People versus Martinez, which is at 61 Miscellaneous 3rd, 383. You can Google it. But it talks about what you have to do as a judge to go through, to try to decide, is someone entirely a drug dealer? And are they dealing at a small enough amount, which is a symptom of their addiction? Are they entirely addicted? Or are they just in the business of dealing drugs? That's a very difficult thing to determine. And fortunately, having been doing this for 7 years and 18 on the bench, you try to make those calls right. Do I get everyone right? I probably don't. But I think we are saving a lot more people than we're hurting.
Okay, and real briefly, I got to keep it tight. Karen and Michael, do you agree with Kyle's concern that while the larger system does a lot of good, it can be sort of scammed or gamed here?
I actually agree with Judge DeMarco's response to Kyle's concern. And I think that idea that it's either or is sometimes misplaced, because as an attorney who's represented thousands of clients and sent clients to these courts, I can tell you, you know what, sometimes it's both. Sometimes it actually is both. And New York's definition of sale, if you will, is sort of intent to share, right? So that cloaks, I think, the whole thing. So to answer your question, I really believe that it should be up to the judge. And generally, by the time the judge is given the opportunity to make that decision, these individuals, these defendants, have already been examined, mm-hmm. right? So there's usually information from pretrial or probation or other agencies that talk about the background of this person, that talk about the struggle. And I think you have more information than for a DA to just decide, oh no, you know, I don't think this person really has a drug dependency, a chemical dependency.
Okay, Michael Downser.
Is it a concern? Sure, it's certainly a concern. Is it widespread? I don't think so, based on my experience. That was one of the decisions I had to make as a prosecutor in those kind of cases, is you have to look and see, is this person an addict who is dealing drugs to support a habit? Or are they a drug dealer who is preying off people's weakness for profit? And that was one of the things that I thought that I gained credibility with the judges who ran those courts when I did go in there and say, yes, I consent to this person because I really believe that this person has a problem. And then when if I went in and said no, I think that this person is, for these reasons, I think that I had a lot more credibility because of my willingness to admit when they were addicts who had a problem who could be addressed by the judicial diversion part. But it's certainly always a concern that you're going to let a drug dealer into a program with addicts.
All right. So you're hearing points of agreement, some disagreement from the candidates. Four candidates for Monroe County Court Judge. Two seats are open on Election Day. And I would say 8 days from now, but early voting has started. And so we will know 8 days from now which two of the four. You just heard Michael Dollinger, Karen Bailey Turner, Kyle Steinbach, John DeMarco, all running for Monroe County Court Judge. This is our only and very short break of the hour. And when we come back, they're going to give you their thoughts on balancing the importance for justice for victims, while also understanding that most people who end up incarcerated are not going to be incarcerated forever, and the role of a judge in starting that process for lives that have to change on all sides. So let's get that only break, and we're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a group called Sea Change Communications is bringing their traveling roadshow on climate education across the country, and they're in Rochester today. Their goal is to open the hearts and the minds of climate skeptics. Now, lots have tried this. They are hardly the first, but they believe their presentation is the most effective yet. Does it work? We're going to find out next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. John DeMarco was doing my job for me earlier when he mentioned his website, so let me ask all four of you. You're going to learn more about Monroe County Court Judge candidates Kyle Steinbach online where?
KyleForCountyCourt.com.
KyleForCountyCourt.com. John DeMarco, do it again for yours?
Yes, JudgeJohnDeMarco2019.com.
Karen Bailey Turner?
KarenBaileyTurner.com. KBTForCountyCourt@gmail.com. Facebook page, Twitter, Instagram, all Karen Bailey Turner.
Michael Dollinger.
It's DollingerForCountyCourt.com and Facebook if you look up Dollinger 2019.
Okay, so much more information out there. And I'm going to be very strict and try to keep this to about a minute and a half apiece. And I'm going to start with Michael Dollinger and go around the table. Balancing the needs for justice for victims, for families, for survivors, with the importance of understanding what rehabilitation might look like. What's the role of the judge and how do you see that work?
Well, thankfully, the need for, in these cases that we're talking about to address rehabilitation, often those are nonviolent felony cases. So there's not as much of a, there certainly are victims, but in nonviolent felony cases, it's mostly a monetary loss. That being said, look, I prosecuted violent felony cases. I prosecuted violent assaults, burglaries, robberies, homicide cases. So As Kyle said before, I've also been in the situations where when you're prosecuting a homicide case, you get to know the family of the victim or the deceased very well. I mean, you often meet with them three, four, five times upcoming to trial, and then it's not unusual for them to attend the trial. I prosecuted five homicide cases. I won four of them, and I lost one. And the one that I lost is that's going to stay with me forever. I'll never forget that. You know, hugging the mother of the young man after the court date. I mean, it was a very emotional experience. And having gone through that, I certainly think that I have an insight and appreciation for the needs of the victims and the victims' families. And that being said, my time in the judicial diversion part has given me an appreciation for the value of addressing that underlying criminal behavior and the good work from the crime prevention side, from the reducing the recidivism rates that can come from the treatment courts and for those nonviolent felonies. So I think that those treatment courts have a very important role as long as they are used as they're intended to be with those nonviolent cases.
All right, Karen, 90 seconds. Go ahead.
I think the best way to really balance the rights of both sides is to make sure that attorneys on both sides do the jobs they're supposed to. As a leader on the bench, I think as a judge you need to do that to make sure that the defendant is effectively representing the clients and that the people, as I've indicated before, prosecutors do not have clients, but they're properly and ethically advocating for their position. If a defendant is to be sentenced and there has been a conviction, then I think those issues come up in terms of judicial discretion as to sentencing. Is this somebody who's going to get a youthful offender adjudication, record sealed? Is this somebody who's going to prison? Or is this somebody who's going to get treatment in the community? Those are the type of decisions that you have to make, and have represented thousands of clients now representing the mentally ill at a court. I think I definitely have the background to basically use my judicial discretion in a way that benefits justice.
And briefly, are we getting the right balance right now?
There's always room for improvement. When we have wrongful convictions in our courts, we are not getting the right balance. We have work to do.
90 seconds, John DeMarco.
You know, I think amongst all the folks at the table, I'm the only person that's been a prosecutor. I've been a defense lawyer for 20 years. I've been a town court judge. I've been a county court judge. I've acted as an appellate judge. It takes a lot of different angles of experience to know when to sentence hard, when to sentence firm, when to sentence soft, when to mitigate. I'm always reminded that at the end of the day, we are the only person that stands between the awesome power of the government and the accused. And you have to have grit a lot of times to make decisions that might be unpopular with members of the public, but law or justice requires those decisions. And sometimes those decisions with violent felons can be a very stiff sentence, and with nonviolent felons, an opportunity to take that point in time and improve people's life, probably not to the satisfaction of victims. But that's what being a judge is all about. You can't be afraid of what the public thinks. You have to do what law and justice demands. And I've been doing that for 18 years, and hopefully I'll get an opportunity to do it some more.
Kyle Steinbach.
The most challenging thing is you have to look at the harm that was committed. There's obviously a wide variety of crimes that would end up in front of you as a county court judge, and you have to look at the harm that is committed and go from there. The issue is that sometimes we overlook that there are victims in all of these cases. We call them nonviolent felonies, violent felony offenses. But if you're the victim of any one of these crimes, you feel affected. You want to be made whole. And because we, and by we, I mean the criminal justice system, are so used to some horrendous things, some of the lesser violent felonies don't get the same attention that they should. And if I am elected, I can promise you that all of them will get the same attention. It shouldn't be, oh, I'm going to pay more attention to this because it's a violent felony offense, or I'm going to pay less attention to this because it's a nonviolent felony offense. There is still a victim out there, and they still need to be made whole somehow.
Okay, and just briefly, 30 seconds, making a victim whole, does that always mean as strong a sentence as possible?
No. It doesn't always mean as strong a sentence as possible, and doesn't always mean they're going to get everything that they want. Sometimes you got to make them as whole as you can. But like Judge DeMarco said, you can't always make everybody happy, and that's the part of being a judge.
I want to thank our guests for being here because, as I think they at least all agreed at the outset here, that it can be confusing for voters. There are certain things that they're very limited on what they can talk about as they run for this particular office, running for judgeship. So, but this was a great opportunity to hear them speak about their own qualifications, their backgrounds, how they view these issues affecting our community, and the role of the courts and the bench. And I want to thank all of them for being here. Kyle Steinbach, Assistant District Attorney for the Monroe County DA's Office and Deputy Bureau Chief for Local Courts. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time here. Judge John DeMarco is a Monroe County Court Judge and Acting Supreme Court Justice. We appreciate the time, Judge. Thank you for being here.
I have a great opportunity. Thank you.
You got it. Karen Bailey Turner, who serves as an Associate Attorney at the Mental Hygiene Legal Service at New York Supreme Court Appellate Division 4th Department.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Appreciate the opportunity.
And Michael Dollinger, who worked for 9 years as a prosecutor in the Monroe County District Attorney's Office and for most of the last three has served as Principal Law Clerk to Monroe County Court Judge Christopher Chacho. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for the opportunity, Evan.
Election Day is 8 days from now, listeners, but early voting has begun and you'll have more judgeship candidates. We're talking about Supreme Court judge tomorrow on this program, and more connections coming up next.